Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We're talking with the Reverend Mike Kinman. He's the outgoing dean at Christ Church Cathedral in downtown St. Louis. After 7 years, he's delivered his last sermon there and will soon be leading services at All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California. He's left an indelible mark here as a champion of racial and social justice. His church has been a sanctuary for Black Lives Matter activists. He's raised money for churches damaged by arsonists in the South. He expects his type of social justice mission to continue in Pasadena, and Mike Kinman joins me in studio. It's nice to see you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Don.
I guess we have to call this an exit interview.
It's an exit interview.
Yeah.
I've been having a couple.
I a lot of people are surprised that you've decided to make this this move, Mike. But I also get the impression that maybe you're a little bit surprised by it.
I am. I love St. Louis. I've been here 20 years. My wife Robin and I have raised our family here. And I wasn't looking to leave Christ Church Cathedral. And I was approached by the people of All Saints, which is as extraordinary a congregation as Christ Church Cathedral is. All Saints is equally an extraordinary congregation. Mm-hmm. And the more we entered into conversation, it's just one of those things that started feeling right. It felt like a genuine call. And particularly as Robin, my wife, and I talked, it felt like, yeah, this was time. This was time. But Christ Church Cathedral is an incredibly hard place to leave, and so St. Louis.
Yeah. How are the two places similar?
Similar in that they both have a absolute for generations, commitment to following Jesus through the work of social justice, through meeting Christ on people who are most on the margins, most oppressed, most targeted, and standing with Christ in those places. All Saints Pasadena has been one of the leaders nationally for full equality and marriage equality for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered persons. A former rector of All Saints Pasadena literally laid down on the train tracks in front of a train that was carrying people to the internment camps for the Japanese in World War II. Mm. And so a real sense in both places that the gospel isn't just something that you kind of dabble in on Sunday morning, but it is something that you – it's a full contact sport, and you're out there living it every day. And they do it in incredible ways, just as Christ Church Cathedral has done it in incredible ways.
What will you be bringing from here, from Christ Church Cathedral and St. Louis to Pasadena, that you can put to work to deal with some of the issues that the new church will be dealing with?
I've talked about this a lot, both there and here. And of all the things that have changed me and influenced my leadership here in St. Louis, at the top of the list, and particularly over the last 2 years since the Ferguson uprising, it is listening to the voices of the young, Black, mostly queer leadership that came off the streets in Ferguson, people like Brittany Farrell and Alexis Templeton, people that you have all talked to as well, realizing that this is the leadership that we need to follow, that there are voices here that are some of our best resources as a community. That the wisdom of where to go through this is alive in them, and that we need to listen deeply and follow their lead. I'm already being connected with some voices in Pasadena and in the LA area, where the Black Lives Matter movement is one of the places where it is centered. So much of what I have learned is it's listen deeply. My dear friend Tracy Blackman has a great saying, and she talks about you got to sit down in your discomfort. And so we go to those places where, particularly me as a straight white man, I get really uncomfortable, and then I just lean into it further. And, you know, we bring people from the margins. We put them into the center, and we say, you get to dictate the agenda for the church.
Talk to me for a moment about your impression of the role that young people are going to be playing in the various movements that have evolved since Ferguson, and you talk about the LGBT community. Young people, it seems to me anyway, are a key.
They are, and they're going to play every possible role imaginable. And Starsky Wilson, who's the co-chair of the Ferguson Commission and an amazing pastor here in St. Louis, he's not the only one, uses a great image of find your lane and drive in it. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of what's happened over the last 2 years. I've seen it happen here in St. Louis, where young people are finding their lane. And some are like K.B. Frazier, who is an amazing doctor and a drummer at the Central Reform Congregation. She's doing a 49 days of mourning, a demonstration now, and she's out there drumming. And KB is out in the streets, and people like Brittany and Alexis are also. Rasheen Aldridge is running for Board of Aldermen. He's finding his lane. He's going to work within the system. DeRay McKesson ran for mayor of Baltimore. Brittany Packnett serves on the President's Commission. Some people are creating amazing art and music. So, you know, the role that they are going to play is every possible role imaginable. One of the things that is going to be a thread that I have seen running through it is many of them are rejecting what has been called in the past the respectability politics, which is you kind of have to play nice and dress up and sort of fit into the system. These are revolutionaries. And the revolutionaries, even when they're running for public office, and, you know, Brittany Packnett sits in the Oval Office and talks to President Obama, she doesn't stop being a revolutionary. In fact, Brittany kind of dials it up to 10 when she does that. And so as Reverend Sekou says, and he's been a fixture here, he says, you know, this movement has a certain amount of profanity to it. And if you are more upset by the profane words coming out of their mouth and the profane conditions in which they've been living, there's been problems. And so I think what's going to happen is this is a movement in every one of these lanes that's going to shake people up. And that's a good thing because there's a lot of things that need to be shaken up.
You know, I think of the old movie Network and the character Howard Beale.
I'm mad as hell.
I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore. And, you know, we're seeing that at all levels, not only in this country, but clearly in other parts of the world as well. There is a movement going on all over the world.
There is. I had a wonderful phone conversation with the great Ruby Sales, who is an elder in the civil rights movement, earlier this week. And Ruby talks about a prime issue of today is that we see people as disposable. Mm-hmm. And it's why you get, you know, to me, I was thinking, why do we have some people that I talk to who say, well, I can't make up my mind if I'm supporting Sanders or Trump. And to me, that seems like sort of an odd distinction. But what happens is both of those candidacies in many ways are in response to people feeling like they are being treated as they are disposable. And what we need to do is, first of all, avoid that energy being taken and twisted to say that another ethnic group, a racial group, that's their fault. Get rid of them and then you're fine. And instead to say, how do we address the economic policies? How do we address the fundamental biases in our society, in economics, in education opportunity, in policing, that communicate to people that you are disposable? And instead of doing what oppressive systems always do, which is turn the oppressed against each other. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is a huge teachable moment. I think you look at what happened in Great Britain last week. I think you look at what's happening with the movement of which Donald Trump is a symptom. And it is an incredible dissatisfaction. Will we let that bring us together or will we let that tear us apart?
A lot of people are frustrated by the pace of progress since the Michael Brown shooting. Are you among those? I mean, there have been conversations, there have been people who have been active, but not a lot has happened. Are you among those who are frustrated?
I'm always frustrated, and I'm going to give you a yes and a no. I'm frustrated because people of color have been told for generations, be patient and wait. You know, one of the many brilliant things Dr. King said is justice delayed is justice denied. This is literally a matter of life and death. People are dying fast at the hands of the police. People are dying slow at the hands of lack of education and economic opportunity. This is not a time to drag our feet. So, yes, I'm incredibly frustrated. I also know that systems do not change quickly. There has been very little practical, tangible change in the St. Louis region since Michael Brown was killed and his body lay in the street for 4.5 hours. But what has happened has been incredibly significant. There have been particularly young leaders who have been empowered, who are feeling their power, who are stepping up, who are doing amazing work. There are conversations that are happening and listening that is going on. There's people like Amy Hunter, who's now moved over to Children's Hospital.
She was with the YWCA.
Yeah, and Rena Hajat Carroll at the Diversity Awareness Partnership. There's great people who are doing incredible work of helping us listen to each other in ways that have never happened before. I think of myself personally. I think of how few relationships I had across the Del Mar Divide before August 9th, 2014. And now some of the most important people in my life, people who've changed me, are people that I've met across that divide. So that's happening.
But, you know, the people you're talking about are talking to each other. Mm. And I'm looking at the political side of this because the change, the kinds of changes that are necessary mm-hmm. are going to have some political input. Legislation.
Right.
And that's not happening.
Well, but it's starting to. Again, it's a slow process. The problem is we have reactionary state legislatures that resist any kind of change. Brittany Packnett, DeRay McKesson, and some other activists put together a website called joincampaignzero.org. It is an incredible plan for police reform. They have met with the major candidates on the Democratic side. At least on the Democratic side, there were issues of racial bias in policing, of racial injustice that were covered in debates that have not been covered in recent memory. So this is a part of people finding different lanes to drive in. Yeah, things aren't changing right away, but things are changing, and the process is in place. And so I have great hope for the future. What I think we need to make sure we do is we can't burn out our young leaders. We need to look at how we're going to sustain them in the years to come.
Obviously, you're passionate about this. Just how can you walk away from it here then?
I'm walking away from St. Louis, but this is a national movement. And this is a great conversation I've had with folks in the movement here in St. Louis, is that, you know, I'm moving from the St. Louis office to the Pasadena office. and the folks at All Saints have already been down with this. Yeah. And so we're going to join right in there. And this is, you know, I remember watching the demonstrations in New York after the non-indictment of the officers who killed Eric Garner. And the West Side Highway was packed with people walking up. And I'm watching this on CNN. And I'm hearing the chants that were the chants that were coming off the lips of the young people in front of the Ferguson Police Department because the people had watched the live streams and they'd learned the chants. Yeah. And I got chills. And, you know, this whole thing is happening on Twitter. And so the movement is connected everywhere. And so I'm just moving from one location to another.
So social media has changed a lot
with
regard to this sort of thing.
Yes.
We're talking with the Reverend Mike Kinman, Dean of Christ Church Cathedral. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. We'd like you to be a part of it. Mike, as I'm sure you've learned during the course of this program, is leaving to be taking a new assignment in Pasadena, California. We'll talk a little bit more about that, too, as we continue. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. Send an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you'd prefer to send one of those tweets, do so at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation with the Reverend Mike Kinman, the outgoing dean of Christ Church Cathedral here in town. You mentioned just a moment ago, Mike, that the folks out in Pasadena are right on with what you're thinking and what the mission is going to be. But you've also written here that Christ Church sometimes is not an easy place to go to church. Mm-hmm. And in fact, some people have left your congregation,
absolutely,
haven't they? Go into that just a little bit more. What do you read? How do you read that?
Well, and we're not an easy, and usually what I say after that is thank God. Yeah. And again, not everyone agrees with that. I believe that the gospel is something that is supposed to touch every part of our life. C.S. Lewis once said that the gospel is either of no importance or of infinite importance. Mm. And so if we believe the claims that we're making, it's got a claim on all of us, which means we have to be confronted with all the ways in our lives that we are not loving the way that we could be and that we're not accepting love the way that we could be. And that's hard. And you got to love each other through that. And it means that when tough issues come up, like how we treat those among us who are most vulnerable and oppressed and targeted, we don't turn away from those. And we look them full in the face. And some people either don't want to do that. Some people are also at a time in their life where it's just too much. And I will not. I would never say people who have left Christ Cathedral are not being faithful, because I don't know what's going on in their heart. Mm. But what I do know is that we have to be about the revolutionary gospel of Jesus Christ. And we've got to do that, and then people get to make a choice about, are they going to be a part of that? And we got to, one of my favorite phrases, we have to love each other through it. And everyone has a different role with that. And I think one of the things that I haven't done as good a job at is letting people know that your role doesn't have to be the same as my role. Tracy Blackman once said, she's one of my favorite people to quote, she was talking about once how she was out on the street in Ferguson one night about 9 o'clock, and the young people were chanting, "We're young, we're strong, we're out here all night long." And she said, "I had a moment of clarity." She said, she's like, "I'm not young, I'm not strong, and I'm going to be in bed by 10, but until then, I'm going to give you a bottle of water." Uh-huh. And Tracy got that her job wasn't to stay up until 1 a.m. She had a different role. Not everyone's job is to do what I do, but I want to help you find what your role in this movement is, because the only way we're going to get there is if we get there together.
But there's also something that you hear about from time to time, and that's called Ferguson fatigue. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are tired of hearing about it.
Yeah. And if you're tired of hearing about it, just think how tired you were living it. Mm-hmm. And so Ferguson fatigue is part of a larger thing that we call white fragility, which is we're not, you know, and we were talking earlier about my kids moving across and going to a different school. And part of what I say is, as hard as that's going to be, that's part of how you develop coping skills. Part of the life of privilege that I live as a white person, particularly as a straight cisgender white male person, is I'm not used to being challenged all the time. I'm used to, you know, having lots of affirmation of my goodness. And so I don't have the coping skills. And I'm also used to being able to, when things are hard, turn away from it. You know, to me, the conversations about race and class have been optional. And so I haven't developed the coping skills. You grow up black in this country, it's not an optional conversation. And so, yeah, there's Ferguson fatigue. And my answer to that is, okay, we love each other through that. But that doesn't mean we say, "I'm tired, I'm not going to do this anymore," because my siblings who are black do not have that option. And if I believe what I believe, I don't get to check out either.
Yeah. A lot of people said they just wanted things to return to normal. But what normal is for a black person in America today is not good.
What we believe reconciliation is, what I believe reconciliation is, which is the heart of Christianity. And what Jesus did in reconciliation is, in becoming human, not in a palace, but in a stable, is saying, you go stand with those who are the most on the margins. And so what I would say, yeah, let's get ready. Let's return to normal. And as a white person, let me go stand with the people most at the margins. Let me enjoy their normal for a while.
Yeah. Did you see Ferguson coming? And I don't mean the shooting death of Michael Brown. I mean, you know, what the other elements of that society at that time. Did you see it coming?
No, I didn't. Yeah. And in some ways, I think there's pieces of that that's specific to St. Louis. And in others ways, there's ways that were specific to my own blindness. Ruby Sales, who I mentioned before, had been at Christ Church Cathedral several months before Michael Brown was killed, talking about, as she calls it, the extrajudicial killing of young black men. And so I remember when I saw on Twitter that Michael Brown had been killed, my first thought was, oh, it happened again. And I went about my day, because it has become so normative for this to happen in our country. And so I did not know that community well enough, and that's on me, to know what was about to happen. And the difference is the young people. The difference is the young people who saw his body laying in the street and said, no more. And then, frankly, the difference was also a community that came together in mourning at a candlelight service and were met by police with tear gas and dogs. And that, as much as anything, is what caused this to happen. It was that meeting of resolve and honest, deep grief and mourning by a community with a militarized police force. And it just, you know, it became the spark that started this entire thing that built on what had happened with Trayvon and so many other things that had happened.
Sure. There are a number of people who want to get into this conversation,
right.
So let's bring them in. I'm going to start with Brant, who's calling from St. Louis. Brant, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with Mike Kinman.
Hey, Brant.
Thanks for having me, Don.
Sure.
I just want to make sure that there's this distinction drawn between – there's a lot of things we can draw distinctions between. I used to work with inner-city kids for 6 years. I've been in dangerous situations, and I work with immigrants and refugees now, but I am not in step with you for the concerning the gay and lesbian movement. I mean, I'm for human rights, but some of the things that are going on now are just out of hand. And I want to draw that distinction. I'm still compassionate, but I'm not flaming leftist.
Thank you, Brent.
I'm not sure I understand if there was a question there.
Well, I think it was a comment. Basically, he does not accept the notion of LGBT equality and acceptance.
Well, I disagree, and we could have a really good theological conversation about that. But
yeah, well, there are a number of people out there who join Brent, and I think a growing number of people actually. This movement has really gained momentum in the last couple of years.
Well, and the thing about that is, as human beings, we're wired for relationship, and we're actually wired for loving relationship. And the transformation, I mean, the tipping point that has happened in this country around human rights, and it's called human, it's basic human rights. It's recognizing that people are created gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and human, as everybody is because of relationship, is that as we have become slightly and gradually safer for people to walk in the sun as who they are, we who are, you know, more heteronormative, we have had realized that all along we've had friends and family members, and you know, we've seen relationships that we realize in the language of the church of like, oh my God, that's sacramental, that's beautiful, that's wonderful. How can that not? It's so obviously the grace of God at work. And that's what converts people much more than an intellectual argument. What converts people is the power of loving relationship.
Let's bring in Lynn, who is calling from St. Louis. Lynn, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me. My comment was very simple. I just did not understand, with a country being as smart as we are, with all the Harvards and the Yales and that sort of thing, why is it taking us so long to just respect one another? I'm just really trying to understand why we're not able to do that, but we are as smart as a nation. Print media, radio media, television media, you don't see pleasant pictures of Black people engaged in daily living as responsible citizens. You don't see it on a norm. You don't see Black and white people having the dialogue that we're having right now on a norm, daily basis. You know, we propagandize all of the fighting, the killing, but why won't we talk and show images regularly of Black and white people doing good things and having conversations? Why won't we do that?
Lynn, excuse me for interrupting. We have the point and we have a time constraint here. So let's get Reverend Kinman to respond to that.
So a couple things briefly. First of all, I found that respect, again, it's the power of emotion and how we're hardwired. Over rational thought. And so respecting each other isn't always about how smart we are. This nation, frankly, was not built on an ethic of respect of others. You look at what we did to the natives who were here when we got here. That wasn't respectful. You look at the fact that our economy is based on Black bodies being stolen from Africa, brought here, put into forced labor camps, and having work tortured out of them. That's not respectful. There is a genteel politeness among the people who were the property owners who made the rules of this society. That's different than in our baptismal covenant. We talk about the respecting the dignity of every human being. Now, what I will say is, we are created in God's image and that we're good. And I believe that Americans, just like everyone else, are good. And what is hard is it's easy to respect people you agree with. It's hard to respect across difference because we live in a capitalist society, it's much easier to make money, leading us to the lowest common denominator of respecting those we agree with and denigrating those we have difference with and marketing that to each other. And so what we need to do, and it's what Amy Hunter talks about as fictive kinship, we need to intentionally build relationships of love and respect and deep listening across those differences. Because then we will have those relationships and respect will come. But until that happens, You know, we're going to continue to be fed by the media images. Leon Sharp just wrote a great book about this. We're going to intend to be fed by these media images, and that rather than real relationship will govern our behaviors.
And a lot of – not a lot necessarily, but some of what we get through the media is based on conflict. That's where
–
that's right. That's where ratings come from.
I worked for the Columbia Daily Tribune just out of college, and when the first Iraq war started, the city editor walked – I was in the sports department. City editor walked into the newsroom, looked at the TV and said, good for business, and left the room.
Well, that's what kept Donald Trump going for all those months in the campaign was he was golden, said the president of CBS, because the ratings skyrocketed.
And look how much free media he got.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I have an I just lost one here that I want to find. It's an email from Lisa. Mike, I'm a it's on my computer screen, but it here we go. Mike, I'm a white person. I recognize I benefit from white privilege. As you prepare to leave St. Louis, what do you think are the most important things that white people can do to combat racism and support the Black Lives Matter movement?
I think the first thing that we can do is educate each other. We too often put the burden of educating about race and privilege on those who are the most oppressed. And so in addition to building relationships of deep listening – with people of color, we need to take it on ourselves to learn. And there, again, there's great resources. Amy Hunter, Rena Hajat-Carroll, great books like Witnessing Whiteness, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. There's something the list sort of goes on and on and on. Fantastic book called The Half That Was Never Told, which tells the story of how the U.S. economy is based on slave labor. We need to educate ourselves. We need to think critically about everything that we've taken for granted. We need to allow for the fact that our experiences are not universal. I have grown up and spent my entire life with an incredibly positive experience of policing. And that is, it's not that that's a lie, it's just that it's not universal and that other people have a very different experience. And then we also need to find ways when we confront racism in our daily lives, when we see it, not to drop back, not to sort of say, oh, I don't want to get into it, but to say this is important enough that I'm going to stand up and I'm going to look across that dinner table or across that boardroom or across that classroom and say, you know what, I got an issue with that. I don't believe that. Can we talk about that? Or even, please don't talk that way in my presence.
Mm-hmm. We have an email here from Andrea who raises a point that comes up every time we have the discussion.
Yep.
She'd like to ask you, what's been done to help the victims of the protesters in Ferguson? Since the protests, we have lost several minority-owned businesses on West Florissant that were burned. And she goes on and on, but basically, you know, these people seem to be forgotten people.
I think there are things going on. There's really good there's good neighborhood-based organizations, I know. And first of all, the protests, Ferguson is actually a fairly small place. And the protest movement was happening in a lot of different places. What I would say is there were incidences of businesses being lost and things happening, and people were hurt by that. That frankly pales in comparison to the damage that is done by systemic racism even in our city. There are wonderful community-based organizations like Grace Hill Settlement House, Better Family Life. There are incredible church organizations. The Urban League has been in helping people. So, there are – and frankly, the community has come together around some of these businesses, and help is happening. And so I think one of the things that we do is – and it's absolutely right to have care, concern, and compassion for the people who lost their businesses. But I think we can hyper-focus on that and realize that, okay, so, what's more important? What is more critical situation? The fact that they lost their business, which is tragic, or the fact that if it is a black-owned business, that for a black person to get credit in this country and in this city to start their own business is incredibly more difficult than it is for a white person. And so, yeah, they need some help restarting their business, but let's talk about why it is so much harder for them to start that business and sustain that business because of the color of their skin than it would be if they're a white person.
We'll take another call here, and this time it's Andrew calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for being for taking me on this
sure.
program.
Sure.
But my concern or question is, about tax dollars and the way they're distributed within the city. I drive a lot through the city, and driving through North County, you kind of see, the poorer municipalities. And, poor communities, their tax money is shared within that community, and rich counties, they're shared within rich communities. And there's never any sort of, to me, it just seems that the struggle will always be that poor communities will always be poor, rich communities will always be rich, because there's no sort of, sharing that tax money. Even though as St. Louisans, we all feel a part of the St. Louis community, we are still so, our tax money only goes so far. And I think that kind of, to me, is the crux of racism in St. Louis.
And I will give a big amen to that. And I think an area where that specifically shows is in education, where education is still funded in this country through property taxes. And I look at the schools that people in Clayton and Ladue can go to, and I look at the schools that people in Ferguson, Florissant, and North St. Louis get to go to. There is huge disparity. I look at the schools that, through my privilege, I get to send my kids to, great schools like John Burroughs and Crossroads. And the schools that siblings of mine who are black have the options to send their kids to. Again, as Tracy Blackman likes to say, we send kids to terrible schools and then blame them for not being able to get a job. And so much of that is our aversion, A, to being taxed at all in this country, particularly as people with means. And secondly, the way that we do not like to spread that wealth around. So I agree.
At this point in the conversation, I generally bring up the For the Sake of All report, mm-hmm. which indicates there's an 18-year lifetime expectancy in two zip codes.
Yeah, which absolutely.
I have a tweet here from Richard who says, ask him about the bells. Reverend Kinman used them as our city's voice.
That's Richard Callow. And he actually got to go up and ring them. Thanks, Richard. The bells of Christ Church Cathedral are the best resource of Christ Church Cathedral is the incredible people. But the bells, cathedral bells they're an announcement that God is present in the life of the people, and they're also an announcement that something's happening. And so we use the cathedral bells to celebrate. We rang them when the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. We use them to mourn. We use them when Nelson Mandela died. We use them to mourn the people who were massacred at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston. We use them to let people know that something is happening, that God is alive in the midst of downtown. And I'm confident that's been happening. Oh, we use them like when the Komen race, we ring them for the whole time that people cross the starting line, and we ring them when the Cardinals won the World Series. And I'm confident it's a way that people know that God is alive in the city. And especially downtown. And this is sort of a transition to something that I know Richard and I share. Downtown is my favorite place in St. Louis. It is a place where people from all walks of life are. There are amazing images of God everywhere. Downtown is struggling. But, if I could say one thing to the metro area of St. Louis, is downtown in North St. Louis, our best human resources are there. And some of them are people who are living on the street, and some of them are kids who are going to terrible schools. But downtown is worth it. And St. Louis, come together, and it's not just about the arch grounds. Come together and really work on the systemic issues of homelessness that cause it. Come together and don't just put a whole bunch of cops downtown, but say, what are creating the conditions that cause crime? Not just in downtown, but in other areas here. St. Louis is a great city. St. Louis is worth it. Put the effort not just into Band-Aid solutions, but having the real conversation and figuring out how do we really come together and address the core issues of what's wrong with the city.
Those bells will be ringing in sadness, yeah. Mike Kinman, when you leave, as you will be doing soon. I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Sir.
And best wishes to you as you take on this new assignment, this new chapter in your life in Pasadena, California.
Don, thank you. And thank you for always being so hospitable. And I'm sure my successor will look forward to the same.
And we will look forward to that successor, he or she.
She, yeah.
Has it been selected?
No, it hasn't been selected, okay. But I would say she or he.
Okay, got it.
Right. Okay.
All righty. That's Reverend Mike Kinman, outgoing dean of Christ Church Cathedral. He's moving on to a new congregation in Pasadena, California. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.